This is Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman.
This is Lauren Lester, the voice of Robin and Nightwing.
And you're listening to the DCAU Review,
hosted by Cal and Liam,
streaming at DCAUReview.com
and on your favorite podcast app.
Bruce Wayne is younger.
Where are you going?
Hot date.
Alfred is even more of a badass.
Just who exactly are you?
I'm the butler. And Gotham's villains,
Batman?
No, they must.
It only gets worse from here.
Beware the Batman.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 307 of the DCAU Review. I am Liam. With me, as he always is Cal. And Cal, as is becoming a frequent event, we are running out of episodes of the DCAU, mainline DCAU shows to review. Mm-hmm. And so the always popular and available Elseworlds have come calling once again this week as we take a trip around the multiverse to a show that honestly we had to, I think you and I even had to think about if we had come to this show before or not. Turns out we had one other time. Uh-huh. And for the second time in our 300 plus episodes, we're looking at an episode of Beware the Batman, a short-lived show from the early 2010s.
That is right. Yeah, it's been quite some time, as you said, since we've covered this one. I probably should have looked up the episode number here, but it's way back there. That's all we know.
If memory serves, we did an Elseworlds month. That might have been our first Elseworlds month, and we did that and the Batman and I think a movie. So
yeah, it sounds about right.
That's quite a while ago, but yes, it has been quite some time since we've revisited this world, and we'll have lots to talk about. Obviously a completely different animation style with the 3D CGI animation rather than the traditional hand-drawn stuff. We'll have a new, pretty, at least again, feels new to us because we only reviewed one episode 4 years ago, but a new voice cast to talk about, lots of fun stuff, and a villain which made their animated debut in this very episode. So lots to talk about here as we talk about this week's Beware the Batman episode entitled Secrets. And before we get to the plot, the IMDb synopsis, and all of that great stuff, Cal, I must, of course, remind us that this episode and every episode that we do is sponsored by the Pod Tower YouTube channel, where you can not only get our episodes every single week, you can also get content from the Watchtower Database Boys, including Jump on the Batwagon, which is also reviewing the DCAU shows, but they're doing it in air date order. So a little bit of a point of difference in how they approach these shows, and also the newer sort of long form interview series they've been doing called Intergang, a couple episodes of that already up there, including one with a longtime DCAU writer Rich Fogel. So lots of great stuff up there, including our entire catalog and lots of back catalogs from Tin Talk as well. So head over today if you haven't already and subscribe at youtube.com/thePodTower.
That's right, Liam. And this episode here originally debuted here in the States on the Cartoon Network, or at least according to the Batman Beware the Batman wiki page, on July the 20th, 2013. So only just a bit of a decade old for this episode as opposed to the normal decades old content that we're usually reviewing. But Yeah, July the 20th, 2013, meaning we're coming up here on the 11-year anniversary in just a few months.
Absolutely. So this synopsis is for Secrets, which is written by Mitch Watson, directed by Rick Moralis, with music by Friedrich Wideman and animation by Zentrix Studios. And that synopsis reads as such. Batman is hot on the heels of an extremely dangerous thief named Magpie, but Batman is not the only one after her. Lieutenant James Gordon is after her as well, and the two will ultimately go head to head to catch her. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think they.
They kind of do at the end. We'll get to it.
Yeah.
It's not I don't think there's anything technically factually wrong in the statement, but it's not, I don't think it's a great encompassing of what the episode's about or anything there. But we will jump into plot here, and we open up right in the middle of the action as a villain, which we'll come to find out is the Batman villain Magpie, which is a kind of a fun deep cut as this series, I guess, was kind of known for doing, as we get to some other episodes, an 80s character created by John Byrne. She likes shiny things. She's a thief and she likes shiny things. That's kind of our first introduction to her. And she has a device of some sort that she has placed on top of a security guard in this warehouse that she's ransacking that appears to be, it's putting, we don't know what it does quite yet, but we know it's electrocuting his brain, and typically that's not a good thing, as is, it's safe to say there's some evil is afoot here. And as she continues to torture the man and begins to leave, she runs into none other than the man who we sh who have been told to be to beware of, that being Batman.
That's a good boy, Joe. Just a little longer. Shiny, shiny. Hey, you just hit a girl.
No, I just hit a criminal. You've given me quite a run. Six warehouses, stolen high-tech electronics worth millions.
Really? Millions? I just like the way they sparkled. Mr.
Batman.
Magpie. Ooh, nice belt. Shiny, shiny. Can I have it?
I'm using it right now. How about a shiny pair of handcuffs instead?
And after some discussion, we discover that her, while she is a thief and while she clearly has some revenge on her mind, she's also mostly just fixated on anything shiny, as
That's
we
right.
talk about when we get to voice acting, certainly. So she immediately takes a shine, specifically, no pun intended, to Batman's utility belt, and there are some fisticuffs, but she's just able to escape. And as Batman goes to tend to the security guards, he asks if the guard is okay and if he can tell him his name. And the guard responds that he can't quite remember it. So we quickly establish that this device this that she had placed on this guard's head is wiping memories. So Batman knows there's something more going on here than just a simple robbery attempt. So we then cut to the next morning where we find Lieutenant Jim Gordon. Having breakfast with his daughter Barbara, who is very clearly very interested in his work as
Just
a
you and me, Lieutenant
policeman
Gordon.
and uh, is
Mom's at an
also
early
very
meeting.
interested
We're
in
having eggs and a
Batman.
hole with bacon. So, what perp are you after today?
First, it's Dad, not Lieutenant. Second, perp?
Yeah, perp. Bad guy.
I know what perp means, Barbara.
Just figure maybe I can help. Take a look at the case file. And if I do a good job, you'll introduce me to Batman?
Not this again.
Oh, come on, Dad. I know he helped you out with those Pig and Toad guys.
Barbara, for all we know, Batman could have been working with Pig and Toad. I've told you before, Batman is not a hero. No one who takes the law into their own hands is.
And is also kind of trying to convince Jim that Batman's not such a bad guy, but Jim feels pretty pretty sure that Batman is just as bad as the criminals he fights against. So we're at that point. You know that point in every Batman in every Batman thing.
Where, I was going to say I had forgotten because it has been quite literally years since we have reviewed this show, and having not watched any of it on its original run, I had forgotten where this timeline took place. And it's very clear based on not only this reaction, but also the headline of the newspaper that Jim Gordon is reading, that this is year one, I guess we have to assume for Batman, because it's still not sure Man or Menace. I think I'm obviously in the famous Frank Miller Batman year one, Lieutenant Jim Gordon was sort of established as the lieutenant there during that time. So one would assume this is Batman's very first year of being a crime fighter. So, yeah, it's always got to be that. Can we trust him? Is he, you know, is he someone we can, is on our side? What side is he on? Even if he is on the good side, he's, you know, we can't trust him because anyone who takes law into their own hands is evil in my book. So, yeah.
That's right. So as he goes into work at this crime scene from where Batman and Magpie had their fight the night before, among attending to the crime scene, he notices a batarang and a rope there, so he knows Batman's involved. But he also notices that on this shelf in the security guard's office, there's a box of various files from Blackgate Penitentiary, including one box with a criminal that he knows as Lunkhead. But he also notes that one of the boxes appears to be missing, as there's a displacement of dust on the shovel. So we got some real like police procedural vibes going on in this episode, which I dig. We'll talk about that as it goes on. But
Gordon is has detective skills, not as good as Batman's detective skills, as we'll learn, but they are formidable.
That's right. And speaking of Batman, we cut to Wayne Manor the next day, where Tatsu, who is will eventually become to known as Katana, spoiler alert, but has as thankfully, by the way, that's another thing we should say. Thankfully, there was a previously on for the first episode when we watched this, because again, it's been 4 or 5 years. So at the end of the first episode of the show, Alfred, who has been as a former MI6 agent, they establish, and is actually the one who does most of Bruce's training, it seems. But he's getting older and was in fact injured in the first adventure of this series. And so he's bringing on Miss Tatsu to be sort of his in the field replacement. And it seems as though Bruce and Alfred are going to put her through some tests to see if she's worthy. And so as Tatsu and Alfred discuss things, including her own distaste for the Batman, as she calls him a nut repeatedly.
What do you know about Batman?
Something of a crime fighter, isn't he?
More like a nut. Dresses like a bat, skulks in the shadows.
Nut is a relative term. Compared to his enemies, he seems quite sane.
No. Sorry, still nut. Gotta say, cushy lifestyle you got here, Major. I can see why you stay.
I sense a buck coming.
Don't get me wrong. I owe you more than I can ever repay. And I'm happy to stay until your leg is healed, but...
Things are not always what they seem, Tatsu. Consider that before making any decisions.
Hope I'm not interrupting.
Oh, come in, Bruce. We were just having some coffee.
Bruce Wayne arrives and, as you mentioned, immediately shows off his own detective skills as he quickly deduces that that Tatsu, because of the inflection in her voice and how she tilts her head when she speaks to Alfred, that he must be someone that she knew from when she was a child. And Alfred, in a few moments later, reveals that she is actually his goddaughter, and that her father and Alfred were partners at MI6 before her father was killed. So we have really just rapid fire getting some some exposition thrown at us here. But yes, as they continue towards the Batcave, Alfred is really trying to convince Bruce that that Tatsu is ready to join him in this crime fighting journey, and Bruce decides he's not quite sure yet, but there's more to be seen there as we move to the next night, where Batman and Magpie come face to face once again.
That's right. So after Bruce and Alfred put aside their discussion on Tatsu's potential recruitment onto the team, Batman runs some tests to see if there's any connections between Magpie and the mind wipe victim, who ends up being a guy named Joe Braxton. We find out that Braxton was actually originally a part of a team that was doing some research and at doing these secret experiments. Of course, science gone wrong at Blackgate Prison, where he was employed along with another psychotherapist named Bethany Ravencroft. Bethany Ravencroft, of course, being a red herring for the episode because she has a bird in her last name and our main villain is Magpie. So, of course, it makes sense. Ravencroft has to be the villain at this point. Batman decides to go and do a stakeout that we'll talk a little bit about in visuals because it's a pretty cool looking scene. But after he's briefly distracted by some vagrants that are doing some vandalism, he stops simply by throwing a batarang. He's looking into Miss Ravencroft's or Dr. Ravencroft's office. She disappears, only for Magpie to appear directly in front of him, knocking him off his feet.
You know, after we last met, I couldn't help wondering, what makes someone put on a bat costume? Something to hide?
Who said this was a costume?
I like that. You and I should be friends. We've so much in common.
Not gonna happen.
What's the matter, Bat Boy? Too much bird for you to handle? Too bad. I was looking forward to getting my hands on that shiny, shiny belt. Goodbye, my little bat.
They have a bit of a back and forth where, again, she requests not only his utility belt and attempts to grab it, but makes some romantic advances towards him. He's not having it. She knocks him off the building and appears to believe that Batman has fallen to his death. She makes off, and then they, of course, just seconds later, Batman reappears behind her, much to her surprise. He asks her what she was doing and what her connection is to the Blackgate experiments. She says that if he catches her, then maybe she'll give up her secret. And thus begins our chase me sequence, sort of, as they chase across the rooftops of Gotham, where they eventually land. And just as she's about to jump off a building, seemingly to nowhere, Batman throws a rope and trips her up. However, before she's able to be pulled up, she these claws that extend out of her fingers grow out, and she actually cuts the rope, leading her to fall and land on top of a car, seemingly to her death. But amazingly, Batman watches as she begins to sort of heal, and her bones begin to reform, and she begins to stand up and walk away. Seemingly no worse for wear. So but Batman gets on the phone immediately. Later on, he's seen in his car. Actually, he's in the back of a limousine, and he's on the phone with Alfred, speaking about his suspicions that Magpie may have been a Blackgate inmate, while both this mind wipe victim Braxton and Dr. Ravencroft were conducting these experiments. She mentioned right before she escaped from Batman the night before, Magpie did, that she refused to be caged again, which is sort of the clue that led him to believe that she may have been one of the victims or one of the inmates. Meanwhile, we see Jim Gordon is off doing his own detective work and runs into the aforementioned Lunkhead, who is loading some boxes into the back of the car. Jim Gordon, for unknown reasons, decides he's going to sneak up on this gigantic hulking man with a rather large bump on his head, where he gets the name Lunkhead. And unfortunately, Barbara calls him at that point at the most inopportune time, allowing his cell phone to go off, alerting Lunkhead of his presence. Definitely scaring poor Lunkhead half to death.
Lunkhead don't like you.
Lunkhead, you're not in trouble. I just want to talk about Batman.
Batman not hurt Lunkhead again?
Barbara, sweetheart, now is not good. Lunkhead, I'm sorry. I know it was Batman who put you away before, that he put you in a coma for 2 months.
Lunkhead not go back to prison. Lunkhead been good.
I know. I just have a few questions and I'll go away. I brought candy.
Gordon is able to convince him that he just wants to ask him some questions after bribing him with a candy bar. And he begins to ask those questions, figuring out just what the link it could be between Batman and Lunkhead, and if he remembers anything about his time in Blackgate and any experiment that was formed on him and someone else there comes out in the discussion. Lunkhead reveals that there was a woman that was with him also being experimented on. And he's able to remember, thanks to a second candy bar, that this nice lady that was very kind to him's name was Margaret Sorrow. So Batman is able to turn up a similar name connected with it during his own detective work. And she apparently was a thief who had vanished 5 years prior after leaving Blackgate. Bruce has this conversation with Alfred, giving him all the details in the back of his limousine as Tatsu is driving him around. It looks like she's agreed to take the job of driving Bruce around, at least for the time being. So they pull up, wouldn't you know, in front of Ravencroft's office, and that's where Bruce decides that he's going to do his own bit of detective work there out of costume, as he, under the guise of getting some psychiatric treatment from a doctor that he purportedly wanted to be out of the public eye, he's introduced also at that time to Dr. Ravencroft's secretary, Cassie, who's extremely excited that she gets a celebrity sighting and does fall all over herself. Bruce starts his session with Dr. Ravencroft and we see that he alerts Alfred back at the Batcave to call Dr. Ravencroft's office mm-hmm. under a guise, which is pretty great. And this forces Cassie to interrupt Bruce and Dr. Ravencroft's session, claiming that there's somebody from the IRS threatening them on the phone line and causing Dr. Ravencroft to leave Bruce alone in her office long enough for him to do some investigative work, which not only reveals a couple of things that he finds. He finds a very interesting bright gold stapler that was something that Magpie, we had seen in the first scene, had stolen out of the warehouse that they were in. And on the bottom of it says property of Miskatonic Psychiatric Hospital. So this is another clue for Bruce, who is left to try and put the pieces together as we move into pretty much our third act here coming up.
That's right. So a Batman arrives at the now abandoned, seemingly Miskatonic psychiatric hospital. And as he's beginning to search around for things, he is quickly attacked by Magpie, who reveals an additional sequence. We already knew she had claws. We already knew she can fall off a building and not die. But we get a little bit more where she, I guess the claws are also poison tipped, or she mentions curare, funny enough.
Yep.
And just as they have a brief fight, but she quickly is able to scratch Batman with those poison claws, which causes him to pass out. And when he awakes, he is strapped to a gurney is that also called a gurney when it's like one of those things where you prop, like the Hannibal Lecter thing?
Yeah, I think it's a gurney because it lays, gurney, right? They ultimately lay flat. You can just lay it up like that too. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that's also a gurney. I don't know. We're not medical experts, but you know.
Feel free to add us at DCAU Review on Twitter and Instagram if you want to tell us the proper name for that, if it has a different name. But yes, as he awakes, we get a little bit more of the backstory as Magpie alerts him that she is she's coming to get her memories back. She knows she was experimented on, but she doesn't quite understand what happened.
Wakey, wakey, eggs and bakey. Don't worry, I didn't peek beneath the mask. A person's secrets are sacred.
Magpie, I meant what I said. I can help.
Quiet! Oh, sorry. That was rude. I appreciate the offer, but I've already got it covered. Braxton created this helmet to remove memories, to reformat the brain's hard drive, wiping it clean. But with a little reprogramming, I found a way to reverse the process, to put the memories back. My memories await. First, though, yours need to go away. I'd say it's been a pleasure, but you won't remember I said it. So,
But first, she's going to use it one last time in the way it was intended to be used, as she's going to wipe Batman's brain before going to tend to an off-screen woman who we hear yelling, which we will find out pretty quickly is Dr. Ravencroft. But Batman grabs one of the feathers off of Magpie's costume and is able to pick the wrist lock that is strapping him down to this gurney as the machine begins to electrify his brain. But he's able to free his one arm and pull the headset off before it does any lasting damage, thankfully. And so he is off as he continues to be led by the screams of Dr. Ravencroft into another room. He and Magpie have another brief fight, and at which point Magpie's wig is removed, and we find out that Magpie is none other than Maggie, the assistant or secretary of Dr. Ravencroft, who we met earlier in an earlier scene, and that she doesn't quite believe it at first, as it reveals that this headset that was supposed to be removing all evil thoughts from the criminal's brain instead actually sort of severed split her personality to where she was the mild-mannered secretary by day, completely not remembering her criminal past. But after a perhaps prolonged period of dormancy, I think they say 5 years, as they mentioned earlier, that this Margaret Killjoy had disappeared some 5 years earlier. They, after a period, the Magpie persona started rearing its ugly head as it began to claw its way back these memories that she had had put out of her brain. So as they continue to fight, Gordon arrives and actually gets scratched again in the process as they are able to save Dr. Ravencroft, but Magpie goes off running again. Ultimately, she and Batman fight a bit more, and of course, with the biggest roadblock being that she doesn't feel pain, so it's hard to knock her out. But finally, Batman is able to, somewhat violently, as we'll talk about visually, knock her into a large electrical box, which fries her quite convincingly. Doesn't kill her, of course, but is enough to finally put her down as Gordon once again comes face to face and seemingly has Batman dead to rights. But again, we all know how this has to go, because Batman saved Gordon's life minutes earlier when he was seemingly going to be taken down by Magpie. Gordon agrees that he is going to let Batman go just this once.
Is the doctor safe, Lieutenant?
Shake it up, but fine. She had no idea Cassie was once Margaret Sorrow.
Makes sense. Different face, different memories. My guess, Magpie subconsciously drove her here for revenge.
Well, now Margaret, Cassie, Magpie, whatever her name, goes back to jail.
Put her back in the hole that created her. Is that justice?
That's the law.
Will I be getting the same justice?
Yes, but not tonight. Just so we're clear, nothing has changed between us. We aren't friends. You helped me tonight, so I owed you. But the next time we cross paths...
That is the end of our villain escapades there. And as we cut back to the manor for our closing scene, we see Tatsu sort of wandering the manor looking for Bruce. She sees Bruce begin to walk off into another room. She's calling after him. He's ignoring her for some reason. But when she arrives in the room, Bruce has suddenly disappeared, and we see her staring at the fireplace, which she is, of course, not yet aware is the secret entrance to the Batcave in this particular version of Wayne Manor. And then we slowly zoom out and realize that she's being watched by Bruce in the Batcave as he mentions that her first test has begun. So that's our little teaser to keep watching, is that he's begun to at least come around to Alfred's suggestion that she could, in fact, help him out in the field, not just as Bruce Wayne's bodyguard, but perhaps as Batman's as well.
That's right. Yeah. So where do we begin here? All right.
Yeah.
It's always, we will preface our breakdown, I guess, by saying that it's incredibly difficult to do a overarching, do what we do for a show that we don't watch very often, and especially haven't revisited that often. We don't have any nostalgic feelings toward it because of the time frame. At least I don't. Did you watch any of this on its original run?
I don't remember seeing any of it. I was probably working. I probably already had a job by this point, and so I was working. I think this was airing as part of the, at the time, it was the DC Nation block. It was this and the Green Lantern show and Young Justice. And then they would also do little shorts and things as well. It was a pretty, nifty time, I'm sure, if you were able to watch it week to week. But I don't remember it getting re-aired very often. And this is a time when I didn't have access to DVR. So I may have seen an episode or two here or there, but I don't remember seeing it. I don't feel like Cartoon Network re-aired it like they would with Justice League and Teen Titans and those shows that we're much more familiar with from the previous era. So yeah, this is, as far as I know, this is the first time I've ever seen this particular episode, certainly.
Yeah, so it's hard for us to put that through the same ringer as we would some of the other shows that we do, right? Especially also it's a CGI, I mean, when we get to animation and visuals, it's a totally different animated style than we're used to for the majority of our shows. So all of that preface saying, whether our review is the best, this is the best cartoon we've ever seen, or the worst cartoon, we're gonna grade on a curve. At least I've graded on a curve based on the fact that it's hard to know how to put this through the same exact criteria in which we grade the other shows. With that said, it's an interesting episode. I like the idea that there's a little bit of a mystery factor. It feels a little bit too convoluted at points, where it's like, oh, there's a guy and we have to figure out what his relationship is to this other person, and there's her name, but we don't find out her name until this middle of the second act, and then, oh wait, just kidding. You can see it from coming from a mile away that this secretary who's introduced for no good reason is likely going to end up being Magpie. It can't be the most obvious person. It's not the person you most expect or the least expect. It's the person you most medium suspect, as Dwight K. Schrute once said. So of course it's the person you most medium suspect, which is this character that's introduced for no other reason. So yeah, I mean, it's a fine little whodunit, guess the identity of the villainess bit. I think the idea of the contraption being the thing, she's motivated because she wants to get her bad memories put back in her head, her evil memories. I don't know.
Yeah, they try to establish it. I guess Magpie doesn't know Maggie, and Maggie doesn't know about Magpie. So they're both so Magpie is trying to claw back who she was before she was Magpie, which, as we turned out, actually it's Magpie is who she was. And the part she's missing is that she's been this regular old civilian for the last 5 years or whatever.
Right. So yeah. So it's a little bit convoluted. I don't remember if there was an embargo on certain characters or if they just decided, Glenn Murakami, the producer on the show, and then everybody else that wrote and directed it and everybody that was responsible for it, why they went with these more off the beat characters. Not a bad thing. I think we're likely to kind of embrace. We've seen that might be some of the way that they're handling the Batman Caped Crusader casting. You're not going to go right to the Joker, the Riddler, the characters that everybody's seen and everybody's done. Let's do a little bit of something outside of the box and go into these deeper, C-list, D-list, or even just some of the newer characters that haven't had as much exposure in mainstream media. I'm perfectly okay with doing that, but I don't know. It just feels like the story is a little bit convoluted. This character is like a mishmash of like a Two-Face and Catwoman mixed into one. Like you have the split personality. She's clearly like the thief, femme fatale, interested in Batman romantically. Mm-hmm. So it feels almost like these are pastiches for characters that they couldn't use, or you're borrowing from other characters, which it happens all the time. It's not a sin. It just, in this case, I don't know that the execution was as solid as one would expect for some of the names that were attached to the writing and directing and all that. So I think it's not bad. I settled on a 6 out of 10 for my score. I think it's a little bit above average. You still had a mystery. You still had a whodunit thing at the end. The fact that she's was involved in these experiments and was trying to regain her evilness is a little bit silly, mm-hmm. but it's still interesting. I think it's an interesting character, and the character obviously comes back, from what I understand, plays a pretty big role in the rest of the series. So you're just laying the foundation here for more to come for the character. So yeah, for all those reasons, I settled on a 6 out of 10. It is, I think that the most interesting stuff is the sort of parallel detective work between Batman and Gordon, who mm-hmm. don't realize it because they're not working together yet, but they both come to similar conclusions via different ways. Like Jim Gordon goes on his path to do the actual police detective work and interview people that he thinks could be connected. Batman has the technological advantage and is able to sort of piece the puzzle together through mm-hmm. his own detective work. And they both arrive at the same point, which leads to, well, what happens when these two guys start working together? You know, what a formidable team they're going to be. And then a similar storyline that you have of what happens when these folks start working together is, you know, Batman ultimately working with Tatsu. What's going to happen when he finally lets his guard down and sees that she could be he could use somebody out in the field here to sort of watch his back, to assist him, to help him, you know, especially if he's out there in his rookie year, not quite ready for prime time yet. So I think you have some other threads that are a little bit more interesting than the main focus of the episode, which leads me to be like, hey, I kind of want to see how these threads are followed up on through the rest of the series. So that's why I ended up settling on my score.
Yeah, I ended up going with a 6 out of 10. Yeah, I think there's a lot of fun stuff at play here. I definitely agree with you. I mean, I kind of mentioned it during the recap. This has a real Law and Order vibe to it in mm-hmm. a lot of ways, like uh-huh. the middle part where they're kind of puzzling things out, and obviously it's interspersed with these like three separate Batman versus Magpie fights we get, so there's still plenty of action. But I liked that. I like, yeah, like you said, the two very different ways that Gordon and Batman go about their detective work, but ultimately coming to the same conclusion, showing that they're both very capable, I think is fun. I think not always, but a lot of times you do see Gordon as sort of like the hapless guy standing around going like, what does this mean? And then Batman has to just kind of, you know, come in and solve it all for him. So I liked seeing Gordon be more proactive and, you know, in the field working the case. I think that's an interesting side that we probably haven't gotten to see, at least not in a lot of like, you know, cartoon kids media for Batman. So I think that's fun. The setup of Tatsu, who isn't immediately brought into the larger Batman world, so she thinks she's just babysitting a rich guy, kind of gave me vibes, I guess this would have been airing around the same time probably, as the first season of Arrow, when they bring in the John Diggle character, and at first he's just kind of supposed to be babysitting this rich kid and doesn't understand that there's this whole other world of assassins and magic islands and all this stuff that he's going to be exposed to as the show goes on. So feels kind of similar to that that vibe in that way. So I liked that element of it. I like this. We'll talk about it in voice acting probably later. I like how like weird and aloof Bruce Wayne is in this show.
Yeah,
like he's real like that, especially that first scene where he's talking, where he's like doing his little detective trick to reveal that he knows that what he can ascertain about Tatsu and stuff. He feels very much like, I guess, an amalgam, I would say, of Adam West and Michael Keaton to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like where he's a weird guy. Maybe it's the turtleneck too, but he's like, he's kind of a weird guy, but he's just a very aloof guy when he's out of the suit. When he's out of the suit, you don't really get a feel for who he is as a person. So I kind of like that. And I enjoyed, you know, him and Alfred concocting the scheme to get the doctor out of the room so he could snoop as Bruce Wayne was fun. So yeah, there's definitely elements here that I like. Like we said, it's part of obviously a larger overarching narrative and this character character Magpie came back later in the series several times. So I think there's definitely stuff here. And again, using a character that had only appeared a few times, like she has a very memorable debut in the John Byrne Man of Steel miniseries of the late 80s. That was sort of the first post crisis on Infinite Earths Superman origin or early days Superman stories. They did an issue, I think it's the third issue of that series, is where the new version of how he met Batman, which is probably been put out of canon by like six other How Did Batman and Superman Meet origin stories since then, as is the wonder of comic books. But and Magpie is sort of the villain there, and then she would pop up from time to time afterwards. But it is just a weird deep cut villain that didn't really have the staying power that even other villains of that era had, like a Scarface and Ventriloquist kind of came out of that same era of Bat books, and they obviously made a lot more of an impact than she did. But it's a weird fun character to play with in this world, and have her fill, as you mentioned, kind of fill the Catwoman role of this flirty femme fatale that, oh, is there something between that her and Batman? Could there be? Well, we'll have to keep watching to see. So there's a lot of fun pieces here. The episode as a whole is interesting enough. But it's not tremendously memorable as a standalone piece, which, as you said, can often be the problem when we just parachute in on one of these shows and we aren't reviewing it week to week. So with that all being said there, Cal, I will move us on to our visuals and animation section of the episode. Once again, this episode was directed by Rick Morales and the animation provided by Zentrix Studios. Obviously, as you already mentioned, it's a completely different animal. We have the 3D CGI animation, not totally dissimilar from the Green Lantern animated series, which we've looked at a couple of times over the years as well. The thing I really zeroed in on immediately is that everybody, it's a real Pixar body situation. Uh-huh. In both ways, in that the men are all big barrel chested dudes with tiny heads,
little feet, big broad shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, that's probably, you could say the same thing about the DCAU Bruce Timm style. It's a lot of big barrel chested dudes with tiny legs. So
yeah,
it definitely looks different in this 3D animated world though. And then all of the women, I would say, also kind of fit that Pixar style. Magpie in costume, I have questions.
So
for she those... she's very top heavy, isn't she?
There's one scene, yeah, I was like, somebody had a little too much fun with this. I will just say visually, it's interesting. She's a cross between the Fox, 20th Century Fox X-Men Lady Deathstrike, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Lady Gaga.
That's actually very good.
Like early 2010s Lady Gaga. So Lady Deathstrike Gaga is how I would describe her. Can't read her poker face. I was somewhat shocked that I would assume this is TVY7. So here in the US. So I am somewhat shocked that this made it past the A&P that would allow them someone in so scantily clad and buoyant to appear in a children's show, but I guess it's cable children's show. I don't know. Like, well, I don't know.
There is a point where this show goes on hiatus from being aired on Saturday mornings and is moved to the remaining episodes being burned off at like 2 a.m. on Saturday nights. So it may be that the Cartoon Network executives eventually felt the same way as far as the content of the show in certain ways.
Yeah. Well, yes. That said, certainly a interesting character to watch run around on your television program. It didn't seem to me that the, hold on. It didn't seem to me that it would be very conducive in the real world to running around, but I guess you could say the same thing about the Batman costume. I don't know. Enough said about her. The better.
I was going to say, yeah, it is interesting because I was trying to look up like a model sheet for. And a lot of them, if you just, you know, Google search Beware the Batman model sheets, a lot of the designs were done by some familiar names. If you're in the weeds like we are, Shane Glines and Glen Wong worked on a lot of them, Glen Wong especially. But I could not find anyone credited for the Magpie design. Obviously, like with Batman the Animated Series, I'm going to guess that Glenn Murakami and Butch Lukic, who were kind of, you know, the showrunners of this, show, probably it's one of their designs. I'm not sure which one, but it's not that much more like revealing than the costume that the character had in the comics, but it is, like you said, just kind of shocking to see this woman in leather thigh eyes with her shorts riding up and the crop or the halter top. Like, wow, this was on Saturday mornings on Cartoon Network, huh? but yes, other designs, like we said, there's some fun fisticuffs between her and Batman. I think the standout sequence for me, Cal, is probably the chase sequence that we get in the middle of the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they look like
they have kind of a weird cadence when they run, but I enjoy this, the sort of the different cuts and sequences. We get kind of a far off shot where we're kind of watching them, you know, side scroll across the buildings, which love a long-eared Batman. So I'm happy. I do like this Batman design. It almost is like the Nolan suit, color palette wise, isn't it?
Yeah, it's dark on dark, which makes for some interesting visuals, certainly throughout the different scenes. Not like the only thing that throws me off is the eye shape, like. I bought into the sort of Pixarization of everybody's body type. I don't know how Bruce, looking outside of the costume, how his head fills out that cowl in that way, but it just it does, which is fine. It's its own look. It's not a copy and paste of anybody else's Batman looking. I mean, it kind of looks like our original Bob Kane drawing, Bob Kane, Bill Finger version of Batman, in the way that his eyes kind of look that way, but it throws it off because the character's eyes have been those sort of triangular shaped things for decades now. So when they're not shaped like triangles and instead shaped like whatever they are shaped like, it does throw the face off for me.
They also don't like change. They're like, usually that seems like such a shortcut in all of these shows to showing Batman's emotion when he's in the cowl, is to have the eyes sort of change shape with his expression. And they chose not to do that. So I feel like he always looks very kind of blank. You kind of only have his mouth to show off any sort of emotion in his face when he's in the suit.
Yeah, Yeah, it's it's an aesthetics choice by the showrunners to not have that happen, but it is a bit jarring when you're used to that being how Batman emotes, for sure. I did really like the scene, as I mentioned when we were going through the rundown of the plot, the scene where Batman is doing the stakeout on the rooftop, hanging outside of Dr. Ravencroft's office. I liked not only that he's kind of standing there or sitting there. First of all, he looks super cool. I literally wrote down, like, Batman stakeout is why superheroes still today wear capes.
Absolutely.
Like, him sitting on the edge of that building, the cape is like flowing. It's got like the, you know, Norm Breyfogel or, you know, maybe even a Todd McFarlane, not quite the size or the volume that those sort of capes would emote. But similar vibes just kind of going on there with the way that it's flowing off the end of the building there. And then they do something really interesting, because you're kind of following the Batman's eyes, almost a POV shot, looking from window to window where he kind of settles on the doctor. And then it switches from this POV shot to it sort of moves in almost like you're on some, like a drone or something like that. You kind of move in through the window and you kind of get the full view of what the actual scene looks like. Just a couple, I mean, things that obviously in the matter that they're using as far as the 3D and the, you know, the CGI, it's a lot easier than doing it that way than if you were doing hand-drawn animation or digital animation even. So, but just some neat little tricks and things that you could really get away with in this medium that you couldn't in others is one of the things that I noticed. I think the quick cuts and the hand-to-hand combat too, it's interesting that they were very careful. Batman's very defensive in his first couple of interactions with Magpie. It's mostly just blocking punches and kicks. He doesn't land his first punch until I think when they're the second fight that happens on the rooftop, I think. So it's interesting because you don't give too much away of his fighting style, and then he's very clearly caught off guard with trying to make sure that he's not like just decking this woman in the face. So it kind of plays into it, but the way that the camera cuts, and we got all these different quick angles of, you know, of Magpie's fist going up and Batman deflecting it, and then a leg going up and her jumping up and him sort of backing up. And it's some really cool, neat cinematic sequences in the way that they did those little fights. And there's plenty of them. I feel like there's four or five different fights that he has, just hand to hand combat. They did something similar too with when he throws the batarang and she knocks it away, and you kind of follow the batarang on the deflection into the wall. When he pulls out the bat cuffs, they kind of follow the bat cuffs to landing on her wrist, and then it follows back into his hand and they spin around. Her obsession with the shiny things too. Anytime she says shiny, shiny, you know, there's like this glare that comes across the object to sort of really punctuate her shiny, shiny obsession. So definitely some things that they did differently and in this medium that you can do to really emphasize the visual nature of what they're trying to get across as far as the visuals are concerned. I did Magpie super goofy in certain parts, but one of the things I loved was after she knocks out Batman and he wakes up on the gurney, she's standing on a suspended light, swinging on it like a trapeze. Yeah, and she's just swinging on it back and forth. I thought that was super, like just a really fun little detail, like super cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the way he defeats her by like throwing the batarang and hitting an oxygen tank, which flies off and knocks into her, which knocks her into the electrical box or whatever. Like there's some fun like cause and effect stuff done with him. I like a Batman that uses his tool set. It's not exclusively just a punch and kick guy. So I think that's kind of a fun ingenuity way. And as he points out, he has no problem hitting a girl in this episode. So,
yes,
we get plenty of fisticuffs.
That's right.
I like that like weird little problem solving where he's kind of like, okay, every time I fight her, she's faster than me. She's doing something that I can't keep up with. So what can I do? And you see him kind of puzzle it out and and figure it out at the end there. So I like that sequence as well. And like I said, the overall design of the show definitely takes a little getting used to, but overall I enjoyed it quite a bit and ended up settling on a 7 out of 10 for my visual score.
Yeah, I gave it the same exact score. So far, we're 2 for 2. The only other thing that I'll mention, there was 2 things that I neglected to mention. One is when Bruce goes into Dr. Ravencroft's office for the first time. I love the fact she's a psychiatrist and she has ink blot art on the wall, the Rorschach test on the wall as her artwork. And there's this really interesting sequence where Bruce looks at the artwork. And of course, it's an ink blot that sort of resembles two people laying on the ground with a splot, an ink blot in between them. So he has this flashback. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we get the murdered parents in the first episode, from my recollection.
I don't think so.
So this is their way of doing that. Like he looks at the ink blot. You kind of cut to a shot of his face kind of looking concerned as Dr. Ravencroft asks him if he sees anything. And then you kind of, the image sort of shifts into Bruce sitting between his two parents in Crime Alley, cuts back to his face where he kind of, returns to his alter ego, Bruce face. And is like, nah, nothing but ink on a page. So I liked that. And then shortly thereafter, as we mentioned, he has this sequence where he signals Alfred, and I didn't know where to put this other than kind of in this spot, cause it's both sound design and also with the visual, but as he signals Alfred, a red light ignites back in the Batcave where Alfred is waiting. And the sound is the same sound as the Batman 66 bat phone, the red bat phone. So of course, any chance that, modern day creators can to homage Batmans from the past, especially those that were influential in the, in pop culture at the time, for them as kids, they do. And in this case, the showrunners acknowledging and giving a nod to Batman 66 with the bat phone, Alfred answering also as he did so often in Batman 66, although he gets to put on his fake Southern accent in this. So we'll talk about a little bit in voice acting, but those 2 things I thought were great too. But yeah, it's definitely something, like, it wasn't as jarring watching it. You can tell, as far as the CGI advancements we've had and maybe the budget that they had, it's not on the level of like a Incredibles Pixar movie. Yeah. You can tell that their budget was certainly not that high, but also part of me wonders, it's like, why hasn't, I know they, Warner Brothers did the DC Super Pets, but why have they not done a CGI superhero cartoon movie? Like, why have they not, why has Warner Brothers not taken advantage of making kids movies, superhero kids movies? Like, why is that not a thing they've invested in with animation? It's mind blowing.
I mean, especially after, the Sony Spider-Verse movies that were so wonderfully well received, and the first one won an Oscar and all that. And I think the second one was nominated as well. Like, yeah, there's clearly an appetite there, and it would be a great way, like all of these shows that we talk about, where we're such a great way of introducing your bevy of characters beyond Batman and Superman to a younger audience. That would be seemingly a great way to do that as well. But yeah, as of now, other than that Super Pets film, they have decided to go a different route.
Maybe if they get under some sort of stable leadership that doesn't just, ish can projects every 3 weeks, we might see that sometime in the future. Who knows?
Well, we can only hope. But as it stands, a pretty good outing in our visuals department. And that will move us over to music. Now we have, of course, our actual composed music for the episode done by Friedrich Weidmann, and then we have what's the band who plays this?
It's the something something sisters.
Let me just look at it.
DD sisters.
Where's the Batman theme?
Dum Dum Girls, something like that.
God, this is hard. If it tells me who is.
I'm not.
Dum Dum Girls. Okay. Yes, you were right. That's right. So first off, we will mention the, which I'm sure we talked about in our first episode reviewing this several years back, as mentioned, but the theme by the Dum Dum Girls, the Beware the Batman theme that opens us up with this really striking black and red accented title sequence that we get, where we kind of see all the different casts of characters in action, and we see the Batmobile driving around as well. Really like that. It's got a real like 60s like hippie rock thing going on, like psychedelic rock, I guess you'd call this. Like I really like the theme song quite a bit. But then otherwise in this episode, again, we already kind of mentioned the police procedural vibe, and that's kind of what I kept thinking. Like this is the type of music you would hear in like Bones or Law and Order, like especially the sequences where Bruce and Gordon are doing their detective work. It's a lot of like really like simple, you know, a little bit of synthesizer, like you hear like the pipe organ sort of synthesizer sound effect, and then you kind of interspersed with these little like xylophone or triangle plays when like the detective notices something. And then you get kind of maybe the larger crescendo of music when the reveal comes and then the scene cuts or whatever. But I was like, yeah, this fits though, because that's kind of like we said, what the episode is Bruce and Gordon investigating this crime. And, you know, you have your, they kind of for like half a second try to make, like, as I think we mentioned this, try to make you think that the doctor is Magpie. So like there's a little bit of that reveal where when he finds the jewelry in her desk drawer and whatever. So yeah, I thought like they really kind of went with that like cop show feel to a lot of the music sequences, right. Which I liked. And then the other standout music, ironically, given that she, as mentioned, is kind of filling this flirty femme fatale role, I thought the music in that chase sequence sounded an awful lot like the Catwoman theme from Batman the Animated Series. with not an insult in any way. It's certainly not like a one-to-one, you know, copy or anything, but it's has that very same sort of cadence to it and that same sort of rhythm to it that I guess it just makes for a good Batman chasing a sexy lady chase scene music. I don't know what you call that, but it's apparently becoming a genre in and of itself on this show.
There you go. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And by the way, Weidman, who's responsible, by the way, didn't realize this till I looked him up, but he's done a bunch of the other, like he's a DC animated veteran at this point. He did Batman Hush, did a music for a lot of the direct to video stuff. And I think he worked on the Picard Paramount Studios show or Paramount Plus show also. So a lot of like recognizable projects on his resume there. So I think there are a couple of things that I noticed. One, there's more of there's like a stripped down, it's not acoustic, it's just like a stripped down electric guitar that comes out in a couple of the fights between Batman and Magpie, like the actual fight sequences. It reminded me of something that you would have heard in a Batman Beyond. It doesn't sound like the Beyond theme. It sounds like something you would hear in a Christopher Carter composed soundtrack, because it relies so heavily on that electric guitar. And then the other musical point that I had was the, where did I have it? Oh, there's sort of a recurring theme when Batman's just walking around. It happens when he's doing some of the investigative work. It's interesting because it sort of sounds a little bit like Darth Vader's theme. It has a similar note progression, which I also find interesting, because a lot of people said the same thing about the Batman's recent soundtrack and main theme from the latest Batman movie, having similar notes and sound and sort of an homage to that soundtrack. So, interesting that Mr. Weidman may have gone with, something sort of just, it's just casually, usually when Batman's walking around or maybe moving from scene to scene. And then I did like the end crescendo that we get as he's watching, Tatsu on the computer screen and mm-hmm. it was again not the same musical notes used, but it was a similar feeling of a crescendo to the end of Rebirth, where you get the "Welcome to My World," you know, Terry McGinnis sound. So it's sort of that similar crescendo of "The tests have just begun," or "Let the tests begin." As we, you know, he kind of reveals that he's accepted this idea of potentially inviting her into his world. So, all those reasons, I really liked the music. I thought that, just like you said, that it fit everything really well. It fit the sort of detective procedural vibes that we're going for this episode. And for all those reasons, I ended up with a 7 out of 10. What about you?
Yeah, I went with a 6 out of 10, just 1 point lower. But yeah, I definitely agree with everything that you said there. And yeah, I think this, again, hard because we've watched 2 episodes over a 5-year period to really get a sense, but I thought the episode, the music really, really fit the vibe of the episode, which we've always said can be very important. And a more over the top score, I mean, I always go back to when we think about those Marvel cartoons of the 90s and how overbearing their use of music could be. Mm-hmm. And this again, sometimes it's knowing when not to play can be just as important. And as you said, Mr. Weidman, no stranger to DC animation, so he did a very good job there. And with that, Cal, that will bring us to our final category of voice acting. Andrea Romano is still responsible at this point for the casting and directing of our voice cast, but it is, with one exception, pretty much an entirely new cast as far as the roles they're playing, at least. We do briefly hear Tara Strong returning as Barbara Gordon. She's a much younger Barbara, and she's, like I said, very eager to get into the world of crime fighting, even though her dad isn't quite so sure. But it was obviously nice to hear her voice. And playing Gordon, again, not something I remembered at all. Kurtwood Smith, probably best known as the dad from that 70s show, or maybe as the villain from RoboCop if you're a little bit older. But yeah, really good. I almost feel like this Gordon is a little too young for him. Like, I feel like he should be playing like a more grizzled Gordon. But as the episode went on, I just really kind of fell in love with him as this character. Like, I really love the especially the sequence where he's interrogating Lunkhead, and you get to see him be like how he talks to him in that scene and deals with him, where he's not like this hard ass 24/7. He's not this like completely hardened cop that's, you know, throwing punches and plays by his own rules. Like, you know, he's trying to just have a conversation with this guy who's so out of sorts that he's just throwing stuff at him. And he's like, I really enjoyed some of his stuff with in the quieter moments with Barbara in that first scene at breakfast. And then when he's dealing with Lunkhead later, I really kind of started to fall in love with him as Gordon as the episode went on.
Yeah, absolutely. It was again something I did not remember him being. Didn't remember him being Gordon. I don't remember if Gordon was definitely in the first episode. We probably just weren't breaking down the episodes the way we are now, since it was so early on in our run. But yeah, I loved hearing him. Loved his portrayal of him. And similar to you, like initially I was like, oh, he's gonna put his foot in Batman's ass or something like that by the end of the scene. But honestly, like, by the end of that scene, first scene with Barbara, I was like, all right, he's got it. Like, he's figured it out. Like, and then as you said, the scene with Lunkhead, and then as he's doing his police investigative work, I think it makes me interested to hear how the rest of the the series portrayal goes and how, you know, how many more episodes that you get if there's a episode that kind of features him more, because it'd be great to see him interacting with some of the other characters, especially our Batman, on more occasions.
Absolutely. And as we continue through our voice cast, we do have briefly, we have Cree Summer as the voice of Dr. Ravencroft, another familiar name here. Does a good job, not a lot asked of her. As we'll talk about in a second here, we have our main villain also voices the secretary. So that was like, if you didn't already understand like the general nature, as you mentioned, of one of these cop shows where it's never the person that they're leading you to think it is in the first two acts.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe gives it away. But I like her as Mr. Ravencroft. I was like, the name Ravencroft, again, I didn't know where to slot this in necessarily. That's a Marvel. That's like the Marvel Arkham Asylum.
Oh,
so I don't know if that's like a fun little in joke. And I think I saw something in the Beware the Batman wiki, which we borrowed from this week, that the name of the hospital, the Miskatonic, is also an H.P. Lovecraft name, which obviously that's also where Arkham comes from. I should say obviously, because I don't think I knew that, but that's, so that's kind of a fun little twist on that as well. But yes, that's, I was like, is there a DC Ravencroft? I couldn't find anything. So I, as far as I know, that's just another little shout out to the other comics company. But yes, elsewhere in our cast, we have Sumali Montano as Tetsu. Obviously, eventually she'll be Katana. Doesn't get a lot to do, but again, I like her interactions with Batman and Alfred. She clearly has a little bit of person. I like the bit where Bruce gets out of the car and is like, yeah, I go get a coffee or something, and leaves. And she's immediately like, oh, I hate this guy. I hate this guy, and I want to go punch somebody. Like, she's just so, she's fed up with it. She's doing this favor for Alfred because she meant so much to, he meant so much to her father, and she kind of sees him as like an uncle, but she's just immediately like, oh my God, I'm counting the days until I can get away from this rich prick. Like, she's so fed up with him immediately. And I think that's kind of an enjoyable dynamic that she sets up pretty quickly here.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you have to have some sort of tension there, you know, especially if ironically behind the scenes, Bruce is not sold on her being added to the crime fighting part of the team, and she's not sold on taking up this role as Bruce's bodyguard / chauffeur. So you have the sort of two opposite ends of the spectrum there. People are being, or two sides of the same coin, I guess, here, just in different positions here, resisting becoming friends and teammates at the same time. So yeah, she's great. Her interactions with Alfred are the most of what we get. Obviously there's not a ton for her to do in the episode because she's sort of still regulated to the background. She's not fully on board yet, but yeah, it's the small interactions that we get are certainly enjoyable.
Absolutely. And then we'll mention, before we get to our main villains, we also have JB Blanc as Alfred. You might know him best now because he was on the very popular HBO show Barry for several episodes, but definitely got like a I know that guy's face guy. as we often mention these character actors that Andre Romano obviously loved working with. He gets to play Alfred, and he's also a Lunkhead, and as you mentioned, he gets to play Alfred playing a character because he has to put on his fake Southern accent, which that's always a fun layer, I think, when you have an actor has to play their character pretending to be someone else. So there's like, there has to still be a little bit of British in his voice, and he's obviously a much different Alfred than we're used to with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. or with any of the other Alistair Duncan on the Batman or anything. He's not really, he's much more of a fighter, and he has much more of a gruff, you know, he sounds more like he's from like the Blackpool side of England, perhaps. But yeah, so it's fun hearing that. You hear that gruff British exterior, and then you mold that into what is that guy doing a fake voice sound like. So it's like, it's a very layered performance that that Mr. Lunk, that Mr. Blanc gets to do. And then, as mentioned, he also voices Lunkhead in that very funny scene opposite Kurtwood Smith. So he gets some fun stuff to do in this episode. I really like him as just a completely different Alfred than we're used to.
Yeah, we've talked about it here. It's almost like the same thing when you see the Joker or really any of Batman's supporting casts. Like oftentimes that's what people are most interested in, because the characterization of Batman can only veer so far from what we know it. Like, he's going to be a detective. He's going to have the gadgets. He's going to be dark and brooding and have an alter ego. Like, that doesn't really change all that much. What does change is who and what is around him and what the personification of that character looks like. So yeah, the fact that this character is not like a weak, skinny old man, which is what you tended to see, like a man in his 70s and mm-hmm. who you could maybe believe was some sort of secret agent if you so told the backstory, but like is well past his prime in most cases. He's less of a father figure to Bruce and more of a bodyguard, it seems, in this personification, which is why he's looking for more of a replacement. As you mentioned, he's responsible for giving Bruce the training that he has. And so it's a different personification. It's a different portrayal of Alfred. And I think the voice certainly matches the CGI model that they went with, which was a big sort of hulking, wide-shouldered, barrel-chested man. Like, that mm-hmm. not really what you see of Alfred. And obviously they've made it, he's still older than Bruce. He's still obviously injured in this series after the first episode. So he's not going to be the one that's out fighting crime alongside of Bruce. But I think the vocal performance of here certainly matches what we're looking for visually and what they're trying to get across as far as how this Alfred differs than maybe other versions that you've interacted with before.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's this is real, like Jason, like I wouldn't have ever thought Jason Statham could play Alfred, but now I'm like, maybe. That's kind of, yeah, he's just, like I said, a complete different animal than what we're used to with our with how Alfred's portrayed in all these other animated shows we watch. But elsewhere in the show, we have Gray Griffin, or I think she's at the time was Gray Delisle. We've talked about her 100 times. She's another one on that like Mount Rushmore of children's television voice actors with like a Tara Strong or someone like that. It's just, she's in everything at some point. She's Catwoman in the Arkham games. I'm sure we mentioned that before. Has done voices across all the DCAU shows as well. Does a lot of Brave and the Bold voices as well. Her as Magpie, again, maybe it's funny because she also plays Catwoman. So it's like, oh, she's another one of this, like this genre of lady criminals who have the hots for Batman. But so she's good. Like, I like her. Like, there's a definitely like under the general like flirty and sort of quippy nature of the character. And like I said, she keeps her catchphrase is shiny, shiny. She says that about 400 times in this episode. Mm-hmm. But there's like a real, especially I think then that third act when the wig gets torn off and she's staring at herself in the mirror, you really get the sense of like, oh, this person is horrifically disturbed. Like she has a real, she kind of takes it up. Like she really ramps up the crazy, I feel like, as the episode goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, once the reveal happens that this Magpie is the same person that Bruce interacts with in the office, that's sort of, you know, fangirling and crushing all over Bruce Wayne's appearance at her job. You can very much tell that there's a huge dynamic shift in the way that the character is portrayed between those, that brief little interaction that we see there and her being petrified of the scary man on the other end of the phone that's threatening tax implications due to insurance fraud and all that stuff. So yeah, to being this menacing, threatening person that's, you know, about to kill Batman and takes great delight in torturing this person that did experiments on her so that she can get her memories back, and to the reveal of her not recognizing herself in the mirror and sort of having a further mental breakdown at the idea that she's you know, her memories are gone forever and she doesn't have the ability to get them back. So yeah, a strong performance from her. I think her interactions with our lead Batman, certainly there's some chemistry there, which if you're going to have somebody be a romantic interest, even if it's on the villainous side, there has to be something there, as we've learned. So it's a solid thumb up for me as far as her performance.
Absolutely. And then finally we have Anthony Revivar. There's a lot of V's in that name and I apologize profusely. I tried to look for an interview with him so I could learn how to pronounce this name. And there are some interviews, especially from around this time, but nobody says his name, which feels like a trap. Nope. It feels like nobody knows how to pronounce it. Apologies for not knowing that. But you would probably, or folks might know him from things like Starship Troopers, or actually more recently, he's on one of the NCIS shows, I think NCIS Hawaii. He's, of course, playing Batman and Bruce Wayne. Like I said, I don't think he doesn't necessarily do a lot to differentiate the Bruce and Batman voices. But I also think that plays into, as we talked about, his Bruce Wayne. Again, I feel like it takes a lot from like Keaton and Adam West in just how kind of stoic and aloof he is.
Mm-hmm.
Like you never really like every scene he's in. And obviously we know it's because he's Batman and he's trying to test Tatsu and see if she's a worthy, partner for his war on crime and all that. And then we see him trying to play the boy billionaire in the scene in the psychiatrist's office. But it's like, man, this guy's weird. Like he's just got a really weird energy. And again, maybe that also, as mentioned, goes with like the suede jacket and turtleneck they have him in. Mm-hmm. Maybe that maybe that planted the seed in my head before I even heard him talking. But I was like, I feel like there's a lot of Keaton and to an extent Adam West's Batman in Bruce Wayne, perhaps more specifically in this version of Batman.
Yeah, I sort of got, and maybe it's also because I was watching a computer animated television show, but I got like, this would be a good Batman video game voice. Like I could see this being, is it Telltale? Is that the name of it's not the same voice as the Telltale version, but it's like, it gave me that similar vibe of like, yeah, I could see this being a Batman voice. Like mm-hmm. I could buy this as Batman. To your point, yeah, there's not a real differentiation between Bruce and Batman. And depending on the performance, I guess that rings true. Bruce Wayne, Adam West didn't change his voice. Really wasn't until we got to Kevin Conroy that became a thing. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of took a break from that until we got to Christian Bale. And then since then it's continued on and off. But I wasn't offended that there wasn't much differentiation. I think part of me sort of maybe chalked it up to, this is still his rookie season, so hasn't learned the importance or doesn't understand or hasn't thought about that, like the importance of separating the two or there being mm-hmm. a differentiation in their characterization between Bruce and Batman. So I wasn't offended by it. I think that I like the sequence that he does with Tatsu, where he's kind of reading her. He reveals how he deduced what her relationship is with Alfred. I thought that was great because he comes across very emotionless, which is sort of what this Batman, you mentioned specifically how his eyes don't emote anything. He's very even keeled. Like there's not a lot of emotion that comes out of this person. And the only emotion that we get is that brief sequence where he sees the ink blot. And it's just sort of visual where Bruce's eyes go up and sort of, into this traumatic response, but then they return right back to normal and he's communicating very even keeled. So I'd like to chalk that up to, hey, this character is just from whether he's Bruce or Batman, he's just kind of unflappable. He's not really fazed by anything and he doesn't show a lot of emotion. for good reason, because it's kind of one of the tools that he uses in both aspects of his life. So yeah, I liked the performance. It's not, I mean, I don't think I would put it in a top five best Batman portrayals necessarily if we were doing a listicle, but it's fine. I think it gets the job done. And specifically in this episode, his interactions, he has a lot of interactions with Magpie, which as I mentioned I think the chemistry is there. It makes sense. He's kind of cool, calm, collected, and she's just off the wall, zany, you know. Mm-hmm. Given all the repartee, and he's just kind of like, nope, just keeping it here at this level. And I think the strongest interaction that I liked, and why I would like to see more of this show specifically, is his interactions with Kurtwood Smith, especially mm-hmm. that final scene of him, you know, him and Gordon once they're discussing like what the next step is for Magpie. He asks her, you know, what's next for her, and he's like, oh, we're sending her back to Arkham or Blackgate, and he goes, oh, put her back in the cage that created her. Is that justice? And he like kind of mm-hmm. he just kind of lets it hang there for a second, and then Kurtwood Smith comes back real animated, you know, as Gordon, saying, well, it's not justice. That's what the law, you know, it comes down to what the law wants, or it's the, you know, that's the law. So. Some good back and forth there. I think he's got some good interactions with everybody there. So overall, I ended up giving voice acting a pretty solid 7 out of 10. I think Kurtwood Smith, pleasantly non-distracting, despite being a very recognizable voice, and the rest of our voice cast, I think, holding up their end as well.
Absolutely. I ended up settling on a 7 out of 10 for voice acting as well. So believe we matched in 3 out of our 4 categories there, Cal. And at this point, we can begin to tally everything up in our 4 categories. And I believe if I am adding right, my final score ended up a total of 26 out of 40.
That's right. By my math as well, because as you mentioned, we agreed on all but one category in which you were 1 point lower. So that means my final score ends up being 27 out of 40. And Liam, we say it every time we do an Elseworld, but hard to talk about rewatchability as far as, you know, a show that we haven't watched, whether or not we would go back to it. I think because this is a serialized show and there are certain aspects that you would need to understand, we've already established Magpie comes back during this first season. Well, the only season, it's 26 episodes. So she comes back, she plays a role. You kind of need to know a little bit about her backstory. I think it does set up, even though you may be able to piece it together from what you know about Batman, especially Batman Year One stuff. It sets up the relationship between Gordon and Batman. You're obviously laying the groundwork for more of Tatsu and how, you know, what her eventual role will be in supporting Batman. So I mean, I kind of give this like an Orange Cassidy, like, you know, one thumb up, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. hey, if you're going to recommend this, I think it's probably important that you kind of understand one of the main villainesses, his love interest maybe for the series, and and kind of a little bit about, you know, the interaction between Batman and Gordon.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree there. Like I said, having not watched the show in quite a few years, I didn't feel completely lost coming into it. And like I said, I thought created again, it feels like a world building episode as far as you understand the motivations of Gordon and Batman, especially. So totally agree there, Cal. And that will begin to wrap it up for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Whether you do so on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on perhaps, as mentioned, the Pod Tower YouTube channel. Great free way to support us is obviously just to subscribe to us on whatever you listen to us on. If it's happens to be Apple Podcasts, you can also, or Spotify, I think you can rate, give us 5 stars on those platforms. They help. That helps us a lot as far as getting the pod on new listeners. And also, if you are on Apple Podcasts, you can actually leave us a review. And if it's a 5-star review, we will read it on the show and actually send you a little prize ski if you're in the US. So always appreciate people that take the time to do that. That's a great free way to support us, as mentioned. Other ways you can support the pod is by becoming a monthly donator to our pod. There's links in the show notes on how you can do that. We have a few people that donate to us every month, become a monthly supporter. That's greatly appreciated by myself and Cal. And helps ease the burden a little bit of some of those late nights when Cal's editing the show on a Friday night, trying to get it ready for the Saturday morning opening, I know. So really always appreciate that. Another way you can support us is, of course, to head to our merch store and pick yourself up a shirt or a mug or something there. Again, those links are in the show notes. Always appreciate people supporting us, whether you do so monetarily or by one of those free ways, as mentioned. And as we hope you will continue to support us next week when we move into a new month and we pick up with another one of our regular DCAU shows. Well, let's be honest, we don't have a lot of it left, but it's been quite a while since we headed to the sunny skies of Metropolis.
That's right, Liam. And it's time for due celebration. You know, here in 2024, the year of our Lord, we just passed our 86th anniversary of the Man of Steel making his debut way back when in Action Comics. And boy, the Big Blue doesn't look a day over what, 30, 35, depending on who's drawing him, I guess.
Whenever now is.
That's right. Exactly. He still looks young. Wouldn't guess he's 86 for sure. So it's time to celebrate the Man of Steel. And as you mentioned, we don't have a ton of, in fact, we have two episodes we've yet to cover of Superman, and we're kind of saving those based on the crossover stars that appear on the show. So it'll be a little while before we get to those episodes. So what do we do when we've run out of fresh things to do, Liam? You go back to the well. Mm-hmm. And you revisit things that you may have talked about before, but this one we're going way back to episode 12 of the episode of the podcast is the last time we talked about this episode. We're going to do a little re-review action for a couple weeks, and we're going to take a look back at A Little Piece of Home. So the very first episode we just covered last week, the Justice League Unlimited episode that involved the world's most giantest piece of kryptonite. Well, mm-hmm. we're going to look at when kryptonite first reared its ugly head early on in the days of Superman, the animated series. So we'll be taking a look back at that, looking at the scores that we gave our episode then, seeing if we agree with ourselves. Do we disagree now based on our criteria? We'll go a little bit in depth, talk a little bit more about animation and our music and our voice actors and actresses, of course, kind of revisiting and redoing, but not rewriting history because we stick with our scores. But it'll be mm-hmm. fun to look back at that one. We haven't looked at that in quite a while, and I think it's probably been, they've in fact remastered Superman the Animated Series since the last time that we reviewed that. So we can now watch it and review it in glorious 4K. So looking forward to checking out A Little Piece of Home with you next week.
Absolutely, Kel. That's an episode. Not only did we review it more than 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago, probably, we reviewed it with another episode, and I think our full podcast review of two episodes of Superman lasted like 35 minutes. So I think it's suffice to say we left a little bit on the table as far as what we could talk about and analyze with a lot of those Superman episodes that we covered early on in the show. So as a treat, as mentioned, we've kind of run out of most of our new episodes of Superman to review. So the re-review, I think, will be a chance for us to right some past wrongs of this show and give an episode like, as you mentioned, A Little Piece of Home, a little bit of a better look under the microscope and a more in-depth look. So definitely looking forward to doing that next week. But until then, I'm Liam.
And I'm Cal.
And we'll talk to you on the next episode of DCAU.
Adios.